good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, and supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests. And this evening, we're going to be interviewing Candace, who lives in Texas, and we're going to be talking about a macabre experiment that was carried out in her community many years ago. And, of course, the tragic thing is, I believe, that it may well influence many people who are even listening to this program. It was about 1970 when a man named Elie Wiesel wrote a book. It was called One Generation Afterwards. And now, Elie had been in the concentration camps in Germany as a Jewish prisoner during the Second World War. He was about 10, I think, when it all began, and most of his family died. A generation later, he wrote this. There was then a technique, a science of murder. Complete with specialized laboratories, business meetings, and progress charts, those engaged in its practice didn't belong to a gutter society of misfits, nor could they be dismissed as just a collection of rabble. Many held degrees in philosophy, sociology, biology, general medicine, psychiatry, and the fine arts. There were lawyers among them, and unthinkable but true, theologians. And you wonder how people who were well-educated, who had a tremendous amount of knowledge and wisdom, would, of course, enter into an experiment that would lead to the deaths of millions and millions and millions of people. Well, you have to understand that Nazism was simply applied science. That is what Rudolf Hess said of it. And many of the ideas that, of course, were incorporated into the Third Reich and their effort, eugenic effort to kill the Jews and the gypsies and the infirmed and the mentally defective, were really ideas that had come from America and from America's eugenic movement and from Margaret Sanger and the people who surrounded her and who financed her effort. And, of course, after the Second World War, why they stopped calling the movement here in America eugenics, and they began to call it population control. But the idea is this total lack of concern for human life, now really, of course, existed not only in Germany, but right here in the United States. And we saw that manifested in the Tuskegee study, where from 1932 to 1972, they carried out an experiment on blacks in America. They recruited 400 black men with syphilis, and for 40 years, they blocked them from getting treatment so that they would die, so they could autopsy them right here in the United States. And almost all of them did die. I think perhaps only 450 or so survived the experiment. And nobody was ever really punished here in America. Oh, there was a couple of people had lost their jobs. I think the Secretary of Health resigned. But the people who were really behind this macabre experiment were never punished. But if you think that's the only type of experiment like that that's been carried out in America, you're sadly mistaken. As I pointed out in my July-August newsletter, you must understand that there really are people in America who've committed terrible, terrible experiments on human beings. Hundreds of thousands of Americans have been experimented on, and people don't really believe that could be true, but it really is. There are people, and a very, very prominent person, who advocated eliminating 350,000 people a day. His name was Jacques Cousteau. And, of course, he was interviewed for an article that appeared in the UNESCO Courier in November of 1991. But, of course, the American people were never allowed to know what Jacques Cousteau said. Had he been, of course, Jerry Falwell or something like that and made that remark, why would it have been on the front pages of every newspaper and repeated over and over and over and over again ad nauseum? But as long as it was one of theirs who advocated mass murder, Of course, they've concealed that from the American people. Well, with us tonight is Candace, and we're going to be talking about a horrible experiment that was carried out in Huntsville, Texas. Candace, when did the experiment really begin?
Always been part of the Texas prison system. They had received, like, for instance, they would get air conditionings or refurbishing of buildings in exchange for the prisoners volunteering for experiments.
Well, did the prisoners really volunteer, or were they simply coerced into it?
Well, at one time, where the trustees ran the prison system, it was pretty much posted on the sign at that time. Then the trustees, or the turnkey inmates that ran the prison before they stopped that process. Now it's guards, security guards that run it, but they would say, you're going, you're going, you're going. So there wasn't much of a choice, but the informed consents are kind of awkward in their stating, like we were talking about last time on that 354th meeting for the agenda.
Now, remember, this is an entirely different audience, so you go ahead and repeat everything you did before, because these people haven't heard the whole story.
Okay, we were talking last time about the Texas experiments and my thesis that I wrote, and the reason why I went back to master's was to get this out in public in university format approved, so that most people would be able to see it and read about it if they wanted to. The thesis was cut about three times, but what's out there is good enough for you to read. The documents that I have to date are still in huge boxes and file cabinets and everything that I have, but this 354th meeting had what we called the Mycoplasma SP, which they didn't say which species was being used.
All right. Now, this is a meeting. Who was at the meeting?
This is the Texas Board of Corrections.
The Texas Board of Correction. This was the 354th meeting.
Right. It was May 6th.
Who was actually meeting? Was it the Texas Board? Was it the prison officials? Was it the scientists who were involved? Who was it?
Yes, it was all of them. All of them. It was, a meeting where the scientists would come, the researchers would come from Baylor and say, well, we want to do this particular type of experiment. And so they would issue a protocol according to policy and procedure that's there with the Texas Board members. But the Texas Board members were not educated in, like, recombinant DNA techniques that were used for mixing certain bacteria with others.
And they were really creating new organisms.
Right.
And, of course, recombinant DNA was something that was developed, really it all came out of something called the Special Virus Cancer Project, which began about 1962, and it was financed supposedly by the National Institute of Health, but everything points to the fact that the Department of Defense and the CIA were involved in this macabre experiment where they employed literally thousands of leading scientists, not only from America, but throughout the world. And, of course, nobody was to know about this because, of course, the idea that we were going to create terrible new diseases that would kill millions of people was to be concealed from the public as large. After all, how many people would want, after we'd already created the hydrogen bomb that could kill hundreds of millions of people, who would want to create new diseases, who would want to finance that? So this was all top secret, and of course, until recently, very few people had ever heard of the Special Virus Cancer Project.
Right, as was the human radiation experiment.
Right.
Those were kept secret for a long time, too. But the National Institutes of Health had a contract. They were the granting agency on this particular experiment. Protocol that was issued, and the period of grant was from June 26, 1974 through June 25, 1979, and the location of the study was Baylor College of Medicine and the Ramsey Unit of the Texas Department of Corrections.
All right, fine.
Now, what they had used was an influenza and had talked about how it possibly could, because of the association of, I'm quoting here, of inactivated influenza vaccine administration with Guillain-Barré syndrome, all human studies involving influenza vaccinations were suspended. So in other words, they went to the prison system where most of society does not care about prisoners. but they had, under this protocol, and I'll quote again, evaluation of recombinant TS mutant vaccines for influenza A Victoria virus was approved by Baylor College of Medicine 6-22-76, the Texas Board of Corrections 7-12-76, and the National Institutes of Health 6-22-76, Committees for the Review of Human Research. So this was done, and knowing that there was a possibility of Guillain-Barré syndrome that would develop. Now, the informed consent would say something like, and I'm quoting again, I understand that I am consenting to have dropped into my nose a fluid which contains a live influenza virus. I understand that the virus was grown in chicken eggs and that I should not participate if I am allergic to chicken feathers or eggs. Now, be mindful here, and the public should be mindful, that the education of these inmates was probably seventh grade, and that would be stretching it. So they wouldn't know what to ask about, especially in medicine. I'll quote again, I understand that the virus in the nose drops may give me the flu, though the flu caused by nose drops in the studies like these is usually very mild. I understand that I may have such symptoms as a runny nose, headache, muscle ache, joints ache, bad feeling, fever, and even pneumonia. I understand that no currently available medicines can cure the flu, that recovery depends primarily on my body's defenses and usually takes a few days to a week.
Well, that sounds pretty innocuous.
Right. And this was written for the inmates to understand. And I'll go on quoting. I understand that I will be confined to the 11 wing for the period of time when I may be infectious for other persons up to 2 weeks after the nose drops and that I may not have any visitors during this time. Then they collect blood samples, 2 week period, three or over the following 2 weeks, two times. And then it says, quote, I understand that an illness consisting of progressive muscle weakness with pain or funny sensations, Guillain-Barré syndrome, sometimes occurs 1 or 2 months following mild respiratory illnesses. The incidence of this illness is less than one case per month for every million people, but about one person in 20 who develop it die of complications. So these are exactly what the consent form sounded like, but during the protocol when I read, they had already stopped the influenza test in the public, but they went to the prisons to continue it.
All right, fine. So we do know that Guillain-Barré is a potential complication of any influenza vaccine, a vaccination. That's why Dr. Len Horwitz opposes vaccines so vehemently, because his mother, of course, took the influenza vaccine, developed Guillain-Barré, and died.
Right.
Now, where does that then get from there to the mycoplasma experiment?
Well, in this same protocol, there is a listing of bacteria that they were using, and the protocol had the mycoplasma species and all of the rest of the stuff that went with it that we talked about last time.
Now, remember, these people don't know what we talked about last time.
Oh, okay.
So please, go ahead and repeat it here. So were they actually using, then, the mycoplasma to produce influenza?
And that I can't even tell you, but I do know that they said that certain mycoplasma and virus combinations cause acute and possibly permanent pulmonary damage.
All right, for our listeners out there, let me point out that when I went to medical school, influenza was caused by a virus. And it wasn't until the late 70s or early 1980s that, of course, we began to hear about mycoplasms, producing atypical pneumonia. About a quarter of pneumonias were atypical pneumonias. And then after that, we suddenly began to hear about a quarter of influenza was produced by mycoplasma. Now, these were organisms that may have been around, but we never learned about them in medical school. We never learned about them during all my early years of medicine. We certainly were going to meetings regularly, so we weren't hearing about mycoplasms, even though they may have existed. They weren't a source of pathogenic or serious infection. And now suddenly they are. Suddenly they're producing influenza. And, of course, the question is, are these genetically altered mycoplasms? Are they something that they have created to create new diseases? Did you look into that aspect of it at all, Candace?
Well, with the words recombinant DNA, when they use that, then I know that something's going on.
When you use that term, you're talking about man-made recombination of DNA, alteration of DNA, taking it back and forth from one bacteria or from a virus and putting it into a bacteria or from a bacteria into a virus. Yes, a recombinant means that they are actually creating these much more pathogenic entities. And, of course, by this time in the mid-1970s, why, of course, we had already signed the biological warfare treaty that had been actually endorsed, I think, about 1970, but actually signed by Richard Nixon in 1972, promising we would never do any experimenting. We were going to destroy all of our biological weapons. But, of course, that was for public consumption. That was what they told the people of the world. Right. But that wasn't what was really going on because people in government lie.
And these tests were approved as far back as 1966 to continue on with the grants, the National Institutes of Health grant.
All right, fine. So we're now, of course, was this continuing then on into this period in the mid-1970s?
Yes. All and right. This particular test that we were talking about, to explain to the listeners that weren't listening at the earlier ones, the mycoplasma SP doesn't necessarily denote which mycoplasma was being used.
All right, and for our listeners out there, there's a mycoplasma pneumonia, there's a mycoplasma genitalis, there's a mycoplasma fermentis, and a mycoplasma fermentis incognitus, which is genetically altered. And many of these mycoplasms have been genetically altered so that they will actually penetrate the cells and create a chronic infection. And, of course, chronic disabling disease was the purpose behind this. Certainly on the battlefield, it's one thing to kill people, but if you can incapacitate them, why, of course, then they take so many other people to take care of them, and that really is much more effective because it tends to demoralize the enemy, and it also tends to tie up the enemy's healthcare facilities, taking care of people with chronic diseases.
And with the mycoplasma species that they mention in this particular protocol, they also mention Coxsackie viruses, herpes virus, neurotropic viruses, simian virus 40, which is the polio vaccine contaminant.
But this is simian virus 40 is a cancer virus. That was the cancer virus that was in the original polio vaccine that was given to the American people starting in 1955 and was in the polio vaccine that almost all of us got, the so-called Salk vaccine given up until about 1962. They identified this in 1960 and they kept giving it, knowing full well it had the simian virus 40 in it until 1962 and contaminated 90 million Americans with a cancer-producing virus, which is one reason why so many people are coming down with cancer today. But they can't admit that because, my goodness, we wouldn't have any confidence in the scientists if we knew that they'd made a terrible mistake, or at least we assume that it was a mistake, and I think it probably was. Although I will have to admit that if you read the book, The Health Century, by Dr. Edward Shorter, commissioned by the NIH, in that book they tell you that the woman who found the simian virus 40 and reported it was severely punished for daring to find that there was a cancer virus in the polio vaccine. But pick up the story.
There was a January 1976 journal, American Journal of Epidemiology, formerly the American Journal of Hygiene, and this was copyrighted by the Johns Hopkins University School of Hygiene and Public Health, and it says, the title of it is Reviews and Commentary, Human Exposure to SV40, Review and Comment. And that's, I find it interesting that this was 1976, yet in 1977, they were continuing to infect people with the simian virus 40.
They were actually infecting them with the SV40, and I didn't realize that was part of this experiment.
Right.
And of course, this was the first cancer-producing virus for human beings that they ever knew about. In fact, this was the basis of the original genome project, was to find out what gene it was in SV40 that produced cancer. And yet they were infecting people knowingly here in the mid-1970s without necessarily telling them what it was all about. We're going to be back here in just a moment or two with Candace, and this is an incredible, incredible story. The reason you haven't heard of it is because of the degree of control that exists today through the media over what the American people think. this is Dr. Stan here, and our guest is Candace, and of course we're not using her last name. I know who she is, and she comes certainly with the best of recommendations from people who I would stake my life on. But she has done an amazing research project, and of course she collected over a period of years all of these government documents that the government denied existed. And of course she was able to track them down. So they were actually experimenting people then in the 70s with this SV40. They were giving this to the prisoners. Did they tell them they were giving them a cancer virus?
They just said a mix of viruses. It's sort of like what the human radiation experiments were. I can't remember the doctor's name. I read that whole book, but it said he didn't really inform them that they could produce cancer with the radiation, but he just told them it might produce a tumor. So,
a tumor, but of course people would not understand that that was cancer.
Well, the prisoners wouldn't because their education level is not that high, and it certainly isn't in medicine.
All right, fine. So they were using these various viruses on these people without really explaining to them the potential for that. So they're using SV40. What other viruses or bacteria, mycoplasms, were they using? You said they were using this mycoplasm SP, but they didn't tell us which actual breed of a mycoplasm that was.
Not in that particular protocol. In all, I have found eight experiments involving mycoplasmas, but I only found two that were still intact in through the Freedom of Information Act and going to the administration level and researching this. But the other six I found in another thesis that was presented at Sam Houston State University by another cohort, and that's where I found the other six. Now, I have a letter dated February 4th, 1994, to the Trinity River Authority of Texas when they thought it was in the water. And it is signed by Jim Turner, state senator, and Alan Hightower, state representative. And I'll quote this. "We wanted to take this opportunity to inform you of our concerns about the situation in and around Riverside, Texas, where a substantial number of citizens have been stricken with neurological ailments. As you may know, approximately 70 people within 15 miles of the Riverside area have experienced a variety of neurological and neuroskeletal symptoms with no known cause. According to recent press reports, at least 6 people have died in the area as a result of these ailments. Obviously, this is a matter of great concern to the residents of the area. The Texas Department of Health has pledged to fully investigate the matter in and around Riverside. They have also said they would coordinate their actions with other relevant agencies." But what they're saying here, the 6 that died had the Lou Gehrig's disease.
All right. Well, I think that people have to understand that what happened is when they began doing these experiments in the prison and infecting the prisoners, among other things, with mycoplasm, the disease then began to spread not only among the prisoners, but then into the guards, and then the guards' families. And then this whole area here around the Huntsville prison, the people began coming down, many of them, with these neurological diseases like Lou Gehrig's disease, anterior lateral sclerosis is the official name, and MS, multiple sclerosis-like syndromes. And suddenly you're seeing these clusters, and there's no explanation. Why would so many people in one neighborhood be coming down with these diseases? Well, we couldn't let the American people know. I mean, we couldn't any more than we could let them know that we infected them initially with, of course, the SV40 virus with the polio vaccine, and then they changed the monkeys that the vaccine was... Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we were just saying that, of course, you had to keep this secret from the American people. If the American people understood, first of all, that they would contaminated 90 million Americans with a cancer-producing virus, why would lose confidence in scientists? And, of course, as Dr. Sabin, who produced the Sabin vaccine, said, you know, certainly some things you can't let the people know. Some things you're better off not to tell them. So, actually, of course, they produced the original vaccine was the Salk vaccine, contaminated 90 million Americans with the simian virus 40. The Sabin vaccine then was grown not in rhesus monkeys, but in the kidneys cultures from the green monkey. But of course, it was 1972. Now, this started about 1960, 1972. Somebody said, you know, maybe we ought to look at this vaccine and see if there are other monkey viruses in it. In 1972, they found there were monkey cytomegalic viruses in it. Well, now this is an entirely different virus that can produce other types of diseases. Well, we can't let the American people know that. And after all, the polio vaccine is doing so much good in polio. So let's just keep it a secret. We will not tell the American people about that because, well, after all, nobody's dying right now. And they may not be producing any problems at all. You know, they're monkey viruses. And individuals are contaminated. But we can't tell the American people that. Recently, if you notice, they've actually done away with the Sabin vaccine. They've gone back to the Salk vaccine because they can, of course, put a lot of formalin in there and kill everything. And they're hoping, of course, that the Salk vaccine, which is a deactivated or killed vaccine, will not contain the monkey viruses, but they're not even certain of that. But that's why they changed back again, but they don't dare tell the American people because we'd lose confidence in the scientists. And, of course, we're supposed to trust the scientists blindly. We're supposed to trust the government because, well, after all, isn't trust in government what America is all about? So anyway, of course, now this is why they've had to cover up what happened in Huntsville, Texas. So now we know, of course, that they were doing these experiments. And didn't they deny these experiments were taking place, Candace?
They denied them for a number of years and even had made fun of it as an urban legend.
Now, sort of like black helicopters or people who believe that there was a conspiracy behind the assassination of President Kennedy or the people who don't believe what the government tells us about 9/11. Or, you know, they have this sort of deriding a phrase about, you know, these conspiracy nuts.
Right. Well, when you have the documents to back it up, they no longer call you a nut.
They just completely ignore you. Or from a very good friend of mine, I was told, and I believe this man is being quite honest, he told me that several doctors who had looked into this had died under mysterious circumstances. Had you heard that?
I have heard that, but I can't verify that.
All right, fine. All I can do is tell you what I was
told. I know what I've been through with some of the silliness that went on.
Well, what have you been through? What did they do to try to silence you?
Well, there was at one point, and I can't prove any of this, and that's why I really don't like to talk about it, because I can't prove it, but my telephone connection outside, which is on the top eave of the house, was pulled down, and two wires were cut across the street. When the telephone man came out, he said, well, this is kind of odd because it's only your phone that's being affected instead of the whole neighborhood. And then there was, like, cigarette butts found in the backyard, which I have a fenced-in backyard, a privacy fence, and different things like that, and clicking on the phones that you would hear. But there's other people and scientists out there who have dealt with this that I've talked to personally that have said they've become ill or they had their samples tampered with and, their mail tampered with and things like that. So what I underwent was a lot less than what they did.
All right.
I want to remind the people, too, that on the agenda for a regular meeting, which occurred in Houston, the 298th meeting on March 11th, 1968, blood donations were given by these inmates in these units. And it lists several units, and it has a total of 7,506 units of blood that was donated for this period. Now, there's hospitals listed, and it shows how many were listed. Huntsville Memorial Hospital, John Seeley Hospital, MD Anderson Hospital, East Texas Tuberculosis Hospital, San Antonio Tuberculosis Hospital, and others. The majority of inmates did this for donation for commutation of sentence or for monetary gain. And it's not like what the scientists say, like, oh, well, they do it because this is the only good thing that they've done in their life. No, it was because they knew that they could get out of prison earlier or they could retain some money.
All right, fine. So we'll get back to this in just a few minutes. We'll be talking about these mycoplasm experiments because now, of course, we find mycoplasm disease prevalent all throughout our society where it was never prevalent before. And, of course, many of these are genetically engineered. In fact, 40% of the sick Gulf War veterans have a genetically engineered mycoplasm. And, of course, thousands and thousands of them have died. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at the Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Candace, and we'll just call her Candace. And I was just talking about how, of course, you find these mycoplasms in so many of the ill Gulf War veterans. We sent over 690,000 troops to the Middle East to fight in the first Gulf War. Right at the present time, we know is that the year about 2001, 2002, over 190,000 of them had requested disability payment for being totally disabled because of, or at least partially disabled because of Gulf War illness. They admitted at that time that almost 8,000 were dead. According to Dr. Garth Nicholson, he believes about the figure is truly about 28,000 of these young people are dead. And of course, the figure is probably well over 200,000, closer to 300,000 of the Gulf War veterans are ill. They didn't die as a result of enemy fire. They died because of something that our government did in the way of experimental vaccines, and all of their shot records just mysteriously disappeared. Isn't that strange? And whatever happened to those shot records? Why, gee, folks, just nobody knows how it could have possibly happened. But, of course, we can't let the American people know that we used experimental vaccines on our boys, and a lot of them have died. And we have a report put out by the Veterans Administration that quotes many of these young men having been told that they were being forcibly given experimental vaccines before they went to the Gulf. So let's get back then, of course, to what happened in Huntsville, Texas. And they're using these experimental infections on the people, but then they got out of the prison system, and then what happened?
Well, some of the protocols even stated within themselves that they could not guarantee that others would not become infected during these experiments. That a prison setting is completely different. It's not a controllable, like a level 4 lab. The people mill around. They get close to one another. It's extremely close contact. You have to shake down inmates. In other words, put your hands on them to make sure they're not carrying anything. And when these experiments were going on, then of course the guards and any medical personnel or any workers that had firsthand experience contact with these inmates would possibly come down with it. And that's what they had said in their own protocol. And this one particular meeting, which was dated, it's the 302nd meeting, November 4th, 1968. It says, and I'll quote, "Work is to start soon on the conversion of a trustee dormitory at Unit Number 1 into two air-conditioned living areas for rhinovirology research by Baylor University College of Medicine. Materials and equipment for the conversion are being obtained by the university."
But of course, this was all done in the name of science, and these people were scientists, and that's exactly what the Nazis did. Everything they did over there was science. The macabre experiments they carried out in the concentration camp, concentration inmates, were for scientific purposes. What you will never hear in America is that there were 12 million others, other than the Jews, who were killed. And, of course, an awful lot of those were Christians. They were people in the concentration camps, like Carrie Ten Boom's family. I don't know how many of you have read the book The Hiding Place, but her sister and her brother and Corey were all to have been killed. What was their crime? They were Christians who hidden some Jews. And, of course, they were all executed just by a quirk of fate. Why Corey survived to tell her amazing story. And if you haven't read the book, The Hiding Place, understand, of course, that what happened in the concentration camps. And it wasn't just the Jews, but we never tell the American people that, because we don't want the Christians here to realize that bad things do happen to Christians, especially when, of course, the country is taken over by wicked, wicked people.
In the Bacterial Review, September 1966, it states that the title of this is Effective Route of Inoculation on Experimental Respiratory Viral Disease in Volunteers and Evidence for Airborne Transmission. And all of the investigators were the same investigators that did the experiment on the inmates. And it says, quote, "This report will describe studies of transmission of respiratory viral diseases, which were a joint undertaking by the U.S. Army Biological Laboratories, Fort Detrick, Maryland, and the Laboratory of Clinical Investigations, National Institutes of Health, and Infectious Diseases, Bethesda, Maryland."
All right, now this is being carried out at Huntsville?
Right.
All right, fine. All right, so the Christmas, they were creating these infectious respiratory diseases there. But let's get back, of course, to the mycoplasms. Do we have any idea when they introduced the mycoplasms into the prison and, of course, they got out into the general community?
Let me see. I've got that listed on the on number four of the table of contents I sent you with volume one.
Right.
It says, Table 1, Summary of Research Programs Conducted by Baylor University School of Medicine, and that was by the other thesis that was in 1974. These five pages will give you an overview of the amount and types of experiments which were conducted at the Texas prisons from 1968 through 1974. Please note how the mycoplasma experiments coincide with the virus experiments. There were six previous experiments involving mycoplasmas and viruses prior to the 1976 and 1977 documents enclosed. That is a total of eight human experiments using mycoplasma species.
All right, so this is long after we have signed the Biological Warfare Treaty, but they're going ahead and doing the experiments anyway, because, of course, treaties like pie crust are made to be broken. So
right.
We are doing this, and of course these are potential pathological warfare things, and of course there are people in the community now are coming down sick, and a lot of people are getting Lou Gehrig's disease, a terrible, terrible disease, and MS and other similar diseases. So what begins happening in the community?
People start getting sick, and just as I read the letter from Turner and Hightower, when they were looking for what was making these people sick in 94, it wasn't like we didn't have the illnesses before. It just wasn't talked about that much.
All right.
And the research I had done when my son got sick, I found the 1985 paper by Dr. Thomas McPherson Brown, and it was called The Antibiotic Therapy of Rheumatoid Arthritis, which mycoplasmas have been found to cause rheumatoid arthritis. And
was he part of this experiment?
No, he was not.
All right.
Dr. Brown and Dr. Harold Clark came along treating rheumatoid arthritis people long before the steroids came about. But when the pharmaceutical companies came up with the steroids, then they wanted to quash whatever research Brown and Clark were doing because it wasn't monetarily conducive to what the pharmaceutical companies wanted.
Now, for our listeners out there, your son came down with what, a sort of a juvenile form of rheumatoid arthritis?
They were waiting for him to develop juvenile rheumatoid arthritis.
All right, fine. And, of course, Dr. Clark then and Dr. Brown had found that at least some cases of rheumatoid arthritis are actually produced by mycoplasma infections. And about, I was practicing medicine in South Africa between 1974 and 1977, so I was reading all the literature at that time, and I remember coming across these articles talking about the mycoplasm producing rheumatoid arthritis. Now, perhaps every case is not produced by that, but at least some of them were, and the people were responding to antibiotic therapy. But, of course, that wasn't anywhere near as profitable as the steroid or the other therapies they came up with. So, of course, everything was done to play this cause down. But some people, at least some of the people with rheumatoid arthritis and Crohn's disease and many of these other so-called autoimmune diseases, seem to be infectious, don't they, Candace?
Well, even asthma. You know, they treated people with asthma, and there's a book written by Dr. Harold Clark, which is called Why Arthritis, Searching for the Cause and Cure of Rheumatoid Disease. And he explains in this book extremely well of how they were literally ostracized by the medical community because everyone went along with the new drug to make money.
Well, of course, the doctors really never were allowed to realize that there was an infectious basis for some of these conditions.
Well, that's what upsets me more than anything, is that the common doctor, who's your first line of defense in any community, if they don't know about human experiments going on, or they don't know about recombinant DNA techniques being used in these experiments, they wouldn't begin to know what to look for. I started trying to educate the doctors with the research that I had just giving it to them, showing them what was going on.
And of course, you got into this because your son was became very ill.
Right.
How old was he, and when did this actually happen?
He was 10 and a half.
Oh, he was 10 and a half, and what year was this?
That was in 90, last of 97, first of 98.
Okay, this is 1997, and this is almost 10 years after they've unleashed this in your community. So are a lot of people in this area getting sick in the Huntsville area?
Yes, sir. There's a lot of people who are still sick and still coming down with Lou Gehrig's disease. And some of them have heard about my research, and they ask me, they'll call and ask questions, and I'll tell them, I'll refer them to Dr. Garth Nicholson. There were, 22 years before my son got sick, those experiments, the mycoplasma experiment was going on.
And, of course, the residual of this infection is still there all throughout the community. It could have been treated, simply with tetracycline, and they could have gotten rid of this focus of infection, but they didn't dare let the people know, did they?
No, and the doctors didn't know. So now that the doctors are beginning to know, whenever there's a case of what they call walking pneumonia, which is mycoplasma pneumoniae, they then ask the people nowadays, are you having any joint problems, that kind of thing, and then they immediately put them on the antibiotic.
So they're doing a better job then, at least in your area, of treating this.
Right.
Now, did it spread out of the Huntsville area into other regions, do we know?
Well, it would have to because of the blood donations I just read.
Blood donations then would have been contaminated, and they, of course, would have gone into the hospitals and then infected a lot of other people.
Right. And then we do know that Dr. Shai-Ching Lo has his patent, which, in addition to AIDS, he stated that Mycoplasma fermentans incognitus had been implicated in a number of other diseases like chronic fatigue and lupus and collagen vascular diseases.
Fibromyalgia, right.
Right, and even Alzheimer's. And the respiratory distress syndrome, which has really kicked in on me when I read that in their own protocols, they stated in the 1976 minutes, on the 350th meeting, September 13th, 1976, and I'll quote, certain viral and mycoplasma infections may be more important than others in causing pulmonary dysfunction acutely and possibly permanently. Now, one thing that the listeners have to understand is that most doctors look for one cause. They don't look for a multiple pathogens in one person. So when the person comes to a doctor and says, I feel really sick, they'll either look for a virus or a bacteria.
But of course, they were doing dual infections, which would make it much more difficult to identify.
Right. And your symptoms would overlap then at that time. You'd have a myriad of symptoms, and then the doctors would be lost because they'd say, I've never seen anything like this. The tests are coming back normal because you wouldn't have the right test to conduct.
And of course, the thing that this is part of the AIDS that nobody ever tells you, but almost all the people with AIDS also have a mycoplasma infection. So you have HIV, and then you have the mycoplasma. The mycoplasma, of course, actually infiltrates the cell and destroys the mitochondria and gives the people a terrible fatigue that weakens their immune response so that the HIV virus can do its dirty work more effectively.
Right.
And Dr. Shai-Ching Lo, of course, works for the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, and he's written extensively about, of course, the involvement of the mycoplasma in AIDS, in chronic fatigue syndrome, and we have almost 1 million Americans infected with that now. And this is a new disease. We never saw this before. And then, of course, there is the fibromyalgia, probably several million Americans infected with this. And then, of course, the lupus, the Crohn-like disease, rheumatoid arthritis types of disease. He writes this up, in his application. He was writing about this in the mid-1980s. And the average doctor doesn't understand this. They don't read these obscure journals. And they don't understand why these people have these diseases. And, gee, it's just nothing you do. They seem to get better. But, of course, the thing was that a lot of this experimentation with mycoplasma, at least I have been told, dates back to the Germans, to the Nazis, and many of the Nazi scientists who worked on that in Hitler's Germany came over here and continued working at it as they worked, of course, for our government, continuing their horrible experiments that had started in the Nazi prison camps, which is why I started this program. With a quotation from Elie Wiesel's book, mm-hmm. 20 years after.
Well, the thing that most people will recognize, too, is that when we go to a doctor, we do trust them. And the doctors have been duped into believing that a certain disease is caused by this or that. And they're not educated in these particular types of experiments that go on within their own community. And we trust them, and we, it's a shame that I couldn't trust because everyone was saying different things. We can't find anything wrong with him, and I could see very clearly and see what was wrong with him, but that's not unlike what Gulf War illness patients were going through.
And, of course, your son had been completely healthy, and then he comes down with this disease, and he's was he wheelchair-bound?
He was wheelchair-bound, yes.
And, of course, eventually you got him onto antibiotics, and he cleared up?
Yes, sir. He had to stay on the antibiotics for about 2 years, and he's perfectly fine. He's healthy. He's 6 foot. He's running, playing baseball again, basketball, everything that he used to do.
Well, of course, see, this is the thing, and it was only because Candace really began looking into this and doing the research, and it was because it really had involved her son that she was going to get to the bottom of it. And of course, she's uncovered things that, of course, really help us to really understand this macabre experiment. Otherwise, no one would ever know what went on at Huntsville Prison there. And, of course, you actually worked with another lady, too, didn't you, as I remember?
I had started working with Sally Medley, and since that time, we've lost contact with each other. But she was one that formed a group in Huntsville that started asking the senators and representatives what was going on in 94. Now, I had moved back. I had been gone, and we moved back, I think it was in 95 or 96, and back here to our home, and I did not know about the Huntsville mystery illness or anything about the 94 papers at all. Now, when my son got ill, and then I came across Dr. Thomas McPherson and Dr. Clark's article on antibiotic use with rheumatoid arthritis and the word mycoplasma for the first time, one of my longtime friends here said, I've got a whole bunch of papers from 1994 that I saved, and I don't know why I saved them, but I guess they're for you. And then that's when I found out about the Huntsville mystery illness. So that's when I had contacted Sally, and I sat and we sat on the living room floor, actually, and I just spread all the research that I had, and that's when she said I needed to write to Dr. Garth Nicholson, and I introduced myself to Garth. And ever since then, it's been a wonderful relationship with Garth, and he went way out of his way. Before Garth, though, I knew nothing about this. I knew nothing about anything, and that's what makes it so compelling, because what I found on my own was that mycoplasma was at the root of what my son had. And when I found the pediatrician that finally gave the prescription, not very nicely, but he went ahead and gave the prescription, within 3 days after taking that prescription, the symptoms that he had, the headaches, the throat spasms, I mean, it was a myriad of symptoms that this kid had, and they started subsiding. Within 3 months, he was able to walk, not really well, but at least walk. And his legs had gotten as thin as his wrist when he had been perfectly healthy before.
Now, of course, did Dr. Nicholson run blood tests on him to ascertain if he really did carry the mycoplasms?
At the time I met Garth, I had already had him on the antibiotics.
Okay, so
and you can't have the blood test run when you're on the antibiotics.
Okay.
So I had gotten in touch with Dr. Joel Baseman through email and had written to him because I was told, find Joel Baseman, and he's at the University of Texas Science Health Center. So I wrote to him, and I told him about all this research that I was doing, and he said, that sounds good. Call Dr. Gabe Merkin in Kensington, Maryland, that there are a few doctors that treated mycoplasmal infections. So I did call him after Dr. Baseman requested me to, and he took the call, and he said, you are so fortunate that your doctor would listen to you because mycoplasmas cause juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. And at that point, I don't remember much more about the conversation because I remember sitting down and just amazed at, I knew nothing about medicine, Dr. Stan. I knew nothing, and I had to learn. And I studied 14 hours a day learning.
Well, I'm glad you did, and for your son's sake, and then for the sake of the rest of us, because, of course, it was that curiosity then that got you to get the Freedom of Information request out, and eventually somebody there got you the information that pointed to these experiments that were done, and they knew it might very well get out of the prison, and the thing is, they didn't care. Because it's all done, ladies and gentlemen, in the name of science. And you have to understand the mentality of these people, because, you see, they don't look at the world the same way that you and I do. You know, it takes an awful lot of work to take somebody, a normal individual, and it would have a feeling of right and wrong and truth, and then, of course, to send them to university and have them read Kant and Nietzsche and Hegel and of course, Marx, and destroy their faith in God and country and everything else, and then convert them into a monster. But, of course, this is what we're doing in our universities. And as somebody said recently, quoting The Wizard of Oz, I can't give you a brain, but I can give you a degree. They should have said an advanced degree. And we have people working in our universities, and this is not all of them, but we have many people working in our universities who have lost their faith in God and right and wrong. They're involved in some of the most macabre experiments of genetic engineering and cloning and of course, breeding the new supermen and the super race and of course, creating new diseases because there are too many people in the world. And they're really unconcerned about humanity. And this is the problem we face. And maybe it takes people without a medical degree to do the research, to as Candace has done, and, of course, to begin to understand the secret experiments that were done at Huntsville on the prisoners that spread out into the community.
Right. And as a criminologist, I have to think why this was done. And I remember quoting Emil Durkheim, and he was, and I'll paraphrase it, he said that men had a deep abyss. Their desire was a deep abyss. So all social norms and constraints would be pretty much thrown out the window in order to achieve what they wanted to achieve, which was mainly control, power, fame, fortune, that kind of thing.
And, of course, for our listeners, Candace that went on, took a degree and became a criminologist, and you have your master's in what, criminal law?
Master of Arts in Criminology and Criminal Justice.
Okay, and are you teaching at the present time?
Yes, I am teaching.
All right, fine. So, but of course, it was this investigation that led her into that. Well, if you're up there in the Great Northwest listening to our program, or here in the Central Coast of California, you'd like to talk to Candace, we'll open up the lines here for a few minutes before we have to disconnect with our listeners in the Great Northwest, and then of course we'll be talking to her during the next hour. But if you're up there, please give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And, of course, this is an incredible, incredible story because Candace has done the seminal work on the experiments that were done at Huntsville, Texas. Many of them were done afterwards President Nixon had signed the Biological Warfare Treaty. And, of course, we can't tell the American people that. Why, that would mean that our leaders didn't, of course, abide by the treaties we'd signed. But, of course, you have to understand that's always the way that it is. If you've read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, the English went into the First World War because they had to honor a treaty. That wasn't why they went into the war at all. They wanted the war. They wanted to kill as many people as they could so they could justify the League of Nations. And we simply quote the gentleman who was a very liberal individual who believed in treaties and believed in world rule by world law, and he was actually invited to go over all the treaties the British had signed during the First World War, and found out that they'd signed a treaty with the Arabs to give Palestine to the Arabs, and they'd signed a treaty with the French to give Palestine to the French, and they'd signed a treaty with the Jews to give Palestine to the Jews. They didn't believe in treaties at all, but it made a good talking point to justify the war. And it was at that time when, of course, the author of Confessions of a Reformer, and you'll find the entire description there in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, why the author of the book, the Confessions of a Reformer, said, you know, he suddenly realized that, of course, everything was a lie. And unfortunately, nothing has changed. They keep lying to one another. Countries lie to one another. Leaders lie. And of course, but the one thing is they cannot let the people learn the truth. And that's really what's so very, very important about the material that Candace has uncovered about the mycoplasma infections. Now, are the people there in Huntsville today, at least some of them, are getting antibiotics for their illness?
More so than what they had been, because I had given all the doctors the research freely.
Right.
And had kept them up to date.
No, of course, I'm sure that there's nothing more irritating to a doctor, and I know because I've been a doctor and I still am a doctor, than to have a patient who knows something that I don't know is a lot smarter than I am. But, you know, eventually, if you're honest, why, at least you'll listen to what they have to say and check out their facts. And then, of course, if you find they're right, why, you're going to be willing to accept it, even if they don't have a medical degree. So what eventually happened? Did some of the doctors then begin to accept what you had written?
Yes, in fact, I had one doctor, and I won't mention his name, but he said that he had some chronic fatigue patients that he worked with them and told them about the tetracycline treatment, and he had five of them, and four out of the five got better.
And, of course, this is amazing, because if you're dealing with chronic fatigue, these patients just don't get any better. In fact, there was an old sort of a sick joke about chronic fatigue. Is there are two things. There's the good news and the bad news. And the good news is you're not going to die. And the bad news is you're not going to die of this disease. And, of course, these people are incapacitated. And it goes on sometimes for decades. And sometimes, people have this disease 20, 30 years ago, and they're still incapacitated. Remember, this disease came on at about the early 80s, so what are we talking about, 23, 24 years, and some of these people are still incapacitated by this terrible disease. And, of course, it occurred in clusters all across the country, and the CDC did everything they could to block finding out what it was. The government, of course, the Congress, because of pressure from victims, actually appropriated large sums of money for research, and the CDC would spend it for other things or would block any efforts to try to get research to find out what was causing the chronic fatigue syndrome. If you have not yet read the book, Osler's Web by Hillary Johnson, it's a book we certainly recommend that everybody who loves freedom get hold of and read. It's an amazing expose of what government can do to protect a disease from ever being identified and certainly discovered. And to this very day, the CDC is doing everything they can to convince all the people incapacitated by this disease that it's all in their head, just like they've done with the Gulf War illness, and over 200,000 American boys are incapacitated. Boys who went overseas to fight for freedom, thinking, of course, that they were trying to protect our way of life, and, of course, not realizing that they were being used as experimental guinea pigs in macabre experiments by these men who marched to a different drumbeat, who have a different sense of right and wrong. We're just about out of time, so we're going to have to bid adieu to our listeners up there in the great Northwest. And this is the time when you may not like what you've heard this evening. If you'd like to get our latest newsletter, you have to specifically request the July-August newsletter. We'll send it to you. We hope, of course, you'll want to subscribe to the Radio Liberty newsletter on a regular basis. We hope, of course, many of you will join the Radio Liberty family of supporters and help us. It's 5 hours every day. We bring the news behind the news, the story behind the story, to people across America. And you must understand, you're not going to hear this elsewhere. In fact, it's in many ways, we know from Dr. Nicholson that three of his students, at least this is what he told me, three of his medical students who tried to investigate what happened in Huntsville died under very mysterious circumstances. I can't verify. I can only tell you what he told me, and I would tend to believe him. He's an honest man.
Yes.
So this is the point. Of course, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival. We ask you to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And we'll be back again with you tomorrow. Until then, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And of course, we hope that you'll call if you have a question or have a comment, or maybe you'll even want to get copies of this talk tonight as we just go back over Candace's research into the background of the strange illness, of course, that struck Huntsville beginning back in the 1970s. It has continued, of course, since that time. Candace, do we have any idea if they've continued doing experiments there at Huntsville, or does it pretty well end as far as the records you've gotten in the late 1970s?
Well, I was really searching for the mycoplasma, and I know that they have done drug experiments, but I know they no longer donate blood. But I don't exactly know the date when they stopped donating blood. I think they can still donate body parts, but I'm not for sure on that. I remembered mentioning a reporter friend of mine who had recently talked with Garth about what had gone on here, and she interviewed him July 15th of 2003, and Erica Hall is her name, and she sent me a transcript of what Dr. Nicholson said, so I'm going to quote from what he said.
Go right ahead. And, of course, for our listeners out there who don't know who Garth Nicholson is, he taught medical school for 30 years. He was almost like a living legend. I've run into some of his students, and they worship him. He was just such a human fellow. He had written over 500 peer-reviewed articles, held either two or three tenured professorships, was the editor on the editorial staff of at least 10 scientific journals, was the editor of at least two of them himself. I mean, a man, of course, they never could have fired him at MD Anderson Clinic. But, of course, when people started dying and he was threatened, why he moved to California. And, of course, MD Anderson's loss is our gain because he's out here and doing a lot of wonderful work, which he can do now without having to depend necessarily on the largesse of the MD Anderson Clinic, which, of course, was working right along with these illegal experiments. And so this would be very unpopular. But Garth Nicholson is a man of integrity, a man I think that if you haven't heard my interviews with him, we could have a great two-hour interview and may very well be a tape of the month this month. So why don't you go ahead and just read what Garth had told Erica, would you?
Okay, it says, quote, "So there's a very deep-set mentality in Texas about using prisoners for these types of tests. Now, the tests, for example, that Vernon Knight was conducting in the prison system were proved to use one of the mycoplasmas, for example, Mycoplasma pneumoniae, which is a community-based pneumonia, and what they were doing was that they weren't using Mycoplasma pneumoniae, they were using Mycoplasma fermentans. So instead of getting a severe pneumonia and treating the patient so that they would recover, they were dying because Mycoplasma fermentans is actually more lethal than Mycoplasma pneumoniae. So when the guards started to get sick and they came to us because they knew we had worked on Gulf War illness, and we're experts on finding mycoplasma, and the guards knew that they were doing mycoplasma studies, yet they couldn't get any help from the prison system because officially they were denying it, but unofficially they knew what was going on. So they came to us because of what we'd done with Gulf War illness patients and the mycoplasmas that we'd found. So when we tested them, we found was not Mycoplasma pneumoniae, it was Mycoplasma fermentans. None of these people had Mycoplasma pneumoniae, which leads me to believe that they did a bait and switch, that they said they were going to test on the community-based pneumonia in the prison system using aerosols of Mycoplasma pneumoniae, but I think that's not what they used. and that was a July 15, 2003 interview. Now, I've told you that they had denied and even called it an urban legend and stated that there was very few inmates that were used, which is not true with the research that I've conducted. And I have in my hand right now a letter dated March 6, 2000, where from the Division Director for Health Services of the Texas prisons, where they finally admitted, and I'll quote here, there seemed to be some confusion about the actual organism used by Baylor at TDCJ. Baylor used Mycoplasma pneumoniae and not Mycoplasma incognitus. Now, we went back to that one particular meeting, which stated that the protocol that they had introduced to the Texas board members, who also had no education in recombinant DNA techniques, so they wouldn't know what they were reading. You know, they were trusting, as we've all been trusting. And they said, it said in that protocol, Mycoplasma SP. It didn't identify which mycoplasma, along with the Coxsackie, the SV40, the adenovirus, and all the other viruses they had introduced.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, these were all different experiments. And what year was that you're speaking of now, where they introduced the mycoplasma, SP, the Coxsackie, the simian virus forward?
Would be the 1977.
That would be 354th
meeting.
All right, fine. So they were introducing it in 1977, but of course here you're dealing with the early 19, would have to be after the Gulf War, so it would have to be about 1993, 1994,
yeah.
When of course the guards are going to Dr. Nicholson, and of course they're all infected with Mycoplasma fermentans, and of course I'm sure that's fermentans incognitus, which
right.
is, in other words, mycoplasma is a generic term, and then of course you have all sorts of types, pneumonia, inguinalis, genitalis, fermentans, and a whole flock of them. I can't remember them all. And then, of course, a subdivision of fermentans is incognitus, and this is the one that has been genetically engineered. How can you tell it's been genetically engineered? Why? Because on the membrane, you have one of the molecules from the HIV virus. Which, of course, it's a GP120, a glycoprotein 120, which allows the mycoplasma to attach to the cell wall and then invade the cell and, of course, then take over the control of the cell. So what is a mycoplasma doing with the envelope gene of HIV? Why, somebody had to put it there. It just doesn't get there just by itself, folks. There really isn't any Santa Claus. So, you know, the thing is, but how do you let the admit this? You can't admit this publicly. I mean, this is in violation of the treaty we've signed. And so, in fact, if the American people really realize that maybe, just maybe, the HIV virus is genetically engineered, and that's why we're not trying to stop its spread, why, of course, think of the ramifications. Why, you know, over 70 million people are infected at somewhere between 25 and 29 million are dead. Why, that makes Adolf Hitler look like a piker compared with the victims of AIDS. And, of course, remember one thing. The current AIDS epidemic, is being monitored throughout the world. Who is monitoring it? Why, the U.S. Census Bureau. And if you'd like to get in touch with me, find out how you can get those reports from the U.S. Census Bureau. In fact, I think we even put the telephone number in our latest newsletter that you can actually call to get those records from the U.S. Census Bureau. And if not, why, we'll be glad to give you the number, and you can call and get it. They put out a report a couple of times a year to tell what a great job we're doing controlling AIDS. And in many of the major cities of Southern Africa, 40% of the adult population is infected, and they're all going to die. And as I've said before, either the greatest public health failure of all time or the greatest genocidal success of all time. So could this be going on today? Well, we have people who don't value human life. We have people who look at the world differently, people who look at it just as the Nazis did. And, of course, among them were people with all sorts of degrees, educated far beyond certainly their concept of right and wrong or morality. Well, now, Candace, of course, as we're saying we have records that they were using this as late as 1977, but of course they could continue being doing experiments there. You've just never been able to identify anything further, have you?
And it was approved in 1966, though.
Right.
So it was at least 10 years
right.
That they were doing these things. And I haven't, like I said, looked even further into it, and some of the minutes and agendas are not available. Current minutes and agendas are not available, so you have to wait until they get available. Now, remember I had said that I didn't know anything about the 1994 mystery illness. There was a Huntsville item paper dated September 17, 1994, and in the article stated, 8 people from Huntsville area have tested positive for Mycoplasma incognitus. And that was a statement from Dr. Garth Nicholson. And then he says, you shouldn't fool around with something unless you have an antidote. It's the public's worst nightmare, mad scientists out of control.
And I really think that's really what it's all about. It's mad scientists out of control, but the only trouble is they're running the scientific establishment, and those of us who, of course, point out what's going on are labeled as right-wing kooks or people who believe in black helicopters or they believe there was a conspiracy behind the murder of President Kennedy. Or, you know, of course, call it what you will. Anybody who, of course, tells the truth will be demonized and marginalized. And the tragedy is an awful lot of people believe them because they control the media.
So, right.
And now, of course, do we have any idea what's happening to the people in Huntsville today? Now, this is a decade later from that article. That was 1994. This is 2003. Are people still coming down with these diseases?
Yes, they are. I have at least four people that have contacted me with Lou Gehrig's disease. I believe one has already passed away. Another one that contacted me a couple of years back, he is presumably doing better, and his doctor, who was in the Houston medical area, said, well, I don't see what we can lose, because they were pretty much telling him to get his will ready, get everything ready, because he was going to die, because they couldn't do anything for him. Now, there was a report by Frank Bass, who's a staff reporter of the Wall Street Journal, and it's the title of it was "Despite State Assurances, Riverside Fears Something That's Making It Sick." And the article states, "Quote."
No, when is this article?
From the Frank Bass. He was a staff reporter of the Wall Street Journal.
When is the article written, though?
When was it written?
Yes, uh-huh.
That would be in 94.
Okay, 94. Okay.
Right, and it says, according to the state investigation, 10 confirmed and 2 unconfirmed cases of amyotrophic lateral sclerosis were found in the area from 1989 to 1993. 6 occurred in Walker County. But what seemed like a lot to local residents was dismissed as normal by investigators. So here we go, because Gene Bender, one of the state health representatives, stated that Lou Gehrig's strikes 2 out of every 100,000. So here we've got 10 confirmed and 2 unconfirmed, that's 12 cases in this little bitty area of Walker, and 6 had occurred in Walker County, which it's not a very big county. And I don't understand why they wouldn't find it something to look into and just dismiss. But part of the dismissal is to not be embarrassed of what they know they have done.
Well, of course, you know, it's very interesting that the mycoplasma plays a very important Gulf War illness, and they have actually now, the Veterans Administration has admitted that the incidence of anterior lateral sclerosis or Lou Gehrig's disease is twice as great in Gulf War veterans as in the general population. So
right.
If you are a Gulf War veteran and you get anterior lateral sclerosis, why, they'll take care of you. And then you get a government pension. That's not much compensation. I mean, I think that far rather probably get treated and get over the disease, but the government's not going to do that. Not going to admit that, of course, this is an infectious organism that they've created, so, of course, they'll give them a pension until they die. But they have admitted that there's a definite causal relationship with twice the incidence of the disease in Gulf War veterans and the general population. So at least that's a step in the right direction and, of course, confirms exactly what you and Dr. Nicholson have been saying.
Right. Now, in 1996, there was an oral presentation of Edward S. Hyman, M.D., to the Presidential Advisory Committee on the Gulf War veterans' illness, and that was February 2nd, 1996. And he states, and I'll quote, "I am fully aware that insertion of a plasmid DNA into certain bacteria could produce a modified streptococcus or staphylococcus, which upon entry into the human would set up colonies within the body and could cause an illness just like Desert Storm Syndrome. Such a chemical would increase invasiveness via inhalation of an aerosol or via transport across the gut membrane, or it would set up colonization within the human. That would be a germ willfully modified for the purpose, or it may just be a strain indigenous to that area. Such DNA sequences are known already. Some retrovirus could set up the patient even if the viremia was relatively asymptomatic."
All right, first for our listeners out there, plasmids are living forms, not quite like a virus, but somewhat in the same category, that are used to actually infect viruses or bacteria, and that's how you transfer the genes into living organisms. And of course, what they had to do, you want to get a gene from one place to another, well, you put it into either a virus or a plasmid. And of course, you know, when I practiced medicine up until the last few years, we'd never heard of the flesh-eating bacteria. And of course, you've probably heard about it. It's been around for maybe 10, 12 years, maybe 14 years, 16 years. But of course, this is a strep A, streptococcus A is as common as dirt, but it's been infected with a virus. And that's the virus, of course, that infects a bacteria that makes it so pathogenic. And of course, once it gets into the tissues, you have no way of controlling it, either to excise the tissues or simply to take off the arm, or the patient's going to die. Where did we come up with a bacteria infected with a virus? We have to understand what this recombinant engineering is all about. They've learned how to do this, and they do this in the laboratories. And if you look at those things that came out of the Special Virus Cancer Project, they were creating all sorts of new diseases that would create cancers and lymphomas and destroy the immune system. And if you haven't read our July-August newsletter, you need to get a copy of it and read it. And, of course, it will give you the sources of reference where you can begin at least to scratch the surface of this incredible story that has been so effectively concealed from the American people. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But give us a call if you have a question or comment. And of course, we'd be glad to have you talk to Candace, and she's got a tremendous volume of material. And of course, her initial treatise was about 300 and some odd pages, and of course, the university she attended pared that down to about 90 some pages. But at least the information is there about these macabre experiments done in America that most people have never heard of. Now, is there any more material from these various hearings that you think would be significant for our listeners?
Well, they can request the thesis through Sam Houston State University, and I do have the Dewey Decimal number for that. It is R853, H as in Howard, 8, T as in Tom, 332002. And that's at the Sam Houston State University Library.
That's 3853HTR.
Yeah, R853.
HTR?
H8.
I'm sorry. R853HT.
It's H as in Howard. Right. 8, the number 8.
8, okay.
And then T as in Tom.
Mm-hmm.
And then 332002.
H8T3002, is that right?
Right.
H8T3002.
33, there's two 33s after the T.
All right. There's three or two threes?
Two threes.
Two threes, okay.
So it's R853, H as in Howard, 8, the number 8, T as in Tom, 332002. What I wanted to bring up.
Will they make a copy of that for a certain amount of money for people?
Yes, they can.
All right, fine. Can you call them?
You can call them.
They
can
look
up on Sam Houston State University on a general search on the web, and they could find out how to contact them.
All right,
I wanted to mention that I had written to a Captain Gregory C. Gray, who was with the Naval Health Research Center, head of Emerging Illness Division. And I think this was back in November 88 when I was doing, still looking through mycoplasma material. And I wrote him and told him I had been researching mycoplasma infections and found two documents where it stated DNA viruses can infect mycoplasmas. And I found that that was very intriguing, and told him about a book that was titled Cell Wall Deficient Form Stealth Pathogens by Lida Matman, and that I requested a 1938 document that he had concerning mycoplasma pneumoniae. So he sent that to me, and it's written by Hobart A. Reimann, R-E-I-M-A-N-N. And it's a magnificent article, and gave me even more information about mycoplasma pneumonia, how it thought it was just a viral infection, and then they found out that it, later that it was a bacteria. It wasn't viral because it is as small as a virus, and that's what makes what I call it a gem of a germ to use in recombinant DNA techniques, because you wouldn't know. But he describes a lot of symptoms and stuff that my son had gone through, as well as many others here in this area.
And this was 1938, huh?
Right, a 1938 document. So I'm very proud to have gotten that, and I thank Captain Gray for sending that to me. But there's many people that I've met. I've met, through this research, I've met Dr. Harold Clark. I met Pat Ganger, and, of course, Garth and Nancy Nicholson, and I met Ernie Garcia, who is head of the American Contaminated American Veterans Association, Joyce Riley. I mean, there's many people I've met that have helped me so much, Dr. Gabe Merkin, Dr. Joel Baseman, and I wouldn't have been able to go as far if I hadn't had their help in ascertaining more information, more medical knowledge than what I had before, because I didn't even know what an aspirin would do. But after studying, like I said, 14 hours a day quickly, because my son was getting very ill quickly, I had to find out what it was, and I was so grateful that God allowed me to come across Dr. Brown's 1985 paper about using tetracycline for rheumatoid arthritis. And that's what started the whole word with mycoplasma, and that's why I say it's so compelling, because I didn't know Garth, I didn't know anybody or anything about the mystery illness. I just went from there and hypothesized that the mycoplasma was somehow involved in my son's illness. And that's when I got the doctors to give me the prescription, was through that research. And then later I met Garth and spoke with him, and that's when he wrote me a letter and said that most people, especially around the prison units, test positive for mycoplasma infections. And then that just set me on to another course where I needed to write a Freedom of Information Act letter and get the information, because it was all rumor, and I don't go by rumor. As a researcher, I have to have it in hand and look at it. And so that's why I did the Freedom of Information Act letter and found it. Garth is a scientist, and he helps me in that regard, and I'm the investigator, and I can help him in that regard.
Well, of course, there's just so much to do out there. And, if we had the money that they have on the other side, the government has the great foundations which finance so much of this macabre work, organized evil that we're up against, that are creating new diseases and inflicting terrible suffering on large masses of people throughout the world. But we don't have the funding, and so it takes somebody that with a vested interest like yourself, who really knows something's there. And of course, you were motivated by an effort to help your son, and yet I'm sure that as a direct result of that, you've touched many, many people's lives. This is the exciting thing about what you've done and what you've uncovered. And now, of course, you have the documentation of that. Of course, they were saying one thing and doing another, and they really were experimenting there, but they could not let the American people know any more than they could let them know where the West Nile virus came from, or where Lassa fever or Lyme disease or all these new diseases that we have that are afflicting the American people. We can't let them know the truth about what's really going on.
Right, and I had talked about Dr. Hyman earlier, his statement, and he had mentioned the fact that that it was criminal to allow this to happen when, and I'm quoting again, when so many with this illness can be treated with success.
No, because he was well aware then of what was going on.
Right. He said, watching to see how long it takes for the illness to evolve reminds me of the well-known ugly Tuskegee syphilis experiment conducted by my government decades ago.
And, of course, this is what people must understand, is that it didn't stop with Tuskegee. Tuskegee was simply, they wanted to see if they could get away with it. They got away with it. So why should they worry? Nothing's going to happen to these scientists who violate their oath of office, their Hippocratic concepts. After all, it's all done in the name of science, just as it was done in the Nazi concentration camps in their hospitals, just as it was done in the Japanese prison camps under General Shiro Ishii or Colonel Shiro Ishii during the Second World War. It was all done in the name of science, and who can be against science? Well, I can be against science because, you know, what? When you have people doing investigations with no moral restrictions and no compassion and no concern about the ultimate results, why, of course, you've laid yourself open for disaster. Go ahead.
Okay, I have a Houston Chronicle paper before me, and it's dated Monday, July 1st, 2002, so that's not too long ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. It tested an experimental cancer drug on 195 patients without informing them its president, Dr. John Medelson, had a financial interest in the medication.
No, well, what was the date on that?
That is Monday, July 1st, 2002, Volume 101, Number 261.
Okay.
It said that a center official said Sunday that MD Anderson only began telling patients in November if the president has any kind of financial stake in a drug being studied. Such conflicts of interest are the subject of debate in the medical community because they could threaten the integrity of studies. Well, to me, the integrity of studies has already been threatened since the Nuremberg trials, because the Nuremberg trials, in my opinion, was nothing more than to produce a consent form. And I've already read you what the consent forms look like at the prison system. They weren't that great. And I'll go on to quote, "This is a very tough issue," said Dr. Leonard Zwelling, MD Anderson's vice president for research. Academics like to align policies with federal government, but on this issue, the government hasn't spoken with one voice. So when we've been left to formulate policies based on conversations with other institutions and others' mistakes. Now, what this guy did, Medelson did, well, he had a drug called, and I'll spell it, E-R-B-I-T-U-X, Erbitux. It was a drug once touted as miraculous, and but he had stocks in M-Clone Systems, and that was the company sponsoring its development. He developed the drug, and he also was serving on M-Clone's board and retains a large stake in it. So ethical concerns are here for sure, and this is where most of our people drop the ball. I don't care if you're Christian or not. If you've got ethics, you're far above many of the people that are head of these researches. And it said, from 1997 to 2001, MD Anderson investigators gave Erbitux to end-stage cancer patients. Now, that means people without hope, right, who had no conventional alternatives. Most died, though the Post concluded that there's no reason to believe any were harmed by the drug, which is considered relatively safe. But this particular doctor also had a role in Enron Corporation before its bankruptcy.
Well, of course, the problem is that, of course, this is illegal, it is immoral,
yeah.
But, of course, nothing is going to happen to them, because people like this, after all, he was a very high official in the medical school. He is certainly above being criticized, and these people get away with it as long as we allow them to. I think that many of them should be brought before the bar of justice and punished for their crimes, just as, of course, at least a few of the people in Germany were arrested and published for their crimes against humanity and against God. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest this evening is Candace Brown. We're talking about the experiments that were carried out at Huntsville, Texas, but of course we tend to get into a lot of the other experiments that are going on. I was just reading an article today. It's pointing out that, of course, you have all of these ethical bodies at our universities to determine what is ethically and right and ethically wrong. And about half of the people on these ethics committees have a stock in the very companies that they are adjudicating to find out if what they're doing is ethical or not. And, of course, so many of the scientific studies are why, of course, scientists who are doing these studies are getting paid big bucks by the companies that want a certain end result. In other words, they want the scientists to say this is the greatest medicine since Digitalis, and it doesn't hurt anybody, and we're going to make a lot of money out of it. And if you come up and you come up with a report that says this is a terrible drug and it's killing people, do you actually think that you're ever going to get another grant from that company or from anybody else? And the reality is, of course, we have scientists for sale all across America, and, of course, you can't trust the papers that are brought out. And you don't know, in most instances, of whether or not the scientist who's writing this is on the payroll of a company or is going to get a big fancy job working, as vice president of the company, in reward for turning out phony science. Science should be a search for truth. Unfortunately, you have to have truthful scientists before, of course, science is valid. And when you have a society where even the president can't determine the meaning of the word is, should we be surprised that scientists, are quite willing to compromise what they do for advancement, for profit, or for just prestige? And this is the tragic situation we find ourselves in America today. So I think it's so vitally important that people begin to question what's going on. Don't take anything for granted. Do the research yourself, because the life you save, could that be your own or that of a loved one? Well, now, certainly, Candace, as you've just continued with this and you commented that people are still getting ill in the Huntsville area. Are you living there now today or you've moved on?
Yes, I am. I'm still here.
Okay, fine. You're back there after, did you move away for a time?
No, I had moved before the 94 publishing had gone on. I was working in parole at that time, and then I came back to this area. I had also been sick, and I have been clinically diagnosed with chronic mycoplasma infection.
All right, Chris, now, is there anybody else? I know Joyce Riley's been interested in this subject, and Garth Nicholson, and certainly we've been interested in it. Are any of the other major talk show hosts interested in your subject?
Well, I did work with 60 Minutes at one time, and they said it was too complicated. And I find that kind of strange. And then I worked with Extra, and Extra sent me a letter stating that they didn't really want to send anyone down for fear that they might become ill. So I really can't get anyone in mainstream news to do anything on this.
Yeah, I wonder why.
Even though I have the documents, and I have admission that it was done, and the documents speak for themselves. It lists all the researchers. If they want to go talk to the researchers, they've got their names. I've got it all here. And then what I tried to do was put it out there in an approved university format, and that's what I did. And the title of the thesis is Ethical Issues of Human Experimentation with Emphasis on Experiments Conducted at the Texas Prison System. And that was my plan. That was my whole plan to do this, was to get this information out, because I didn't have to go back to master's graduate school, but it was something I felt that I had to do for everyone.
Now, the article was Ethical Issues of Human Experimentation?
Right. Ethical Issues of Human Experimentation with Emphasis on Experiments Conducted at the Texas Prison System.
At the Texas
Prison System.
Texas Prison System.
Yes, sir. Now, I want to read a letter here dated October 23rd, 1998. It's to James F. Henchman, Acting Comptroller General of the United States General Accounting Office, and it's from Bob Filner there in California. and he was pretty much saying that he was writing to ask for an investigation by the GAO for the rejection of the grant application by Dr. Nicholson. And he said that we have information that at least one or possibly both of his grant applications to the U.S. Army Medical Research Acquisition Activity at Fort Detrick on Gulf War illness may have been tampered with, and the priority scores changed from fundamental to unfundable, to fundable to unfundable. And he says the first application entitled Mycoplasma Infections in Persian Gulf War Illness was submitted in April 1995 to Fort Detrick. One of the members of the committee that reviewed the application stated recently that he was surprised that the grant was not funded since it was received as an excellent review. It is suspected that the USAMRAA or their outside contractor changed the review to a negative review and lowered the priority to an unfundable priority to prevent this application from being funded.
In other words, they didn't want to find out why our boys are dying.
Right. A follow-up application submitted to the USAMRAA in 1996 was apparently reviewed not by scientists, but by psychiatrists who may have bias and conflict of interest in this matter and may lack the training and credentials in this area necessary to provide a proper review. My personal observation is that many of Dr. Nicholson's patients are doing better than many of the Department of Defense Veterans Administration patients with Gulf War illness, and that his work is worthy of being funded. Now that's from Senator Congressman Bob Vilner.
Oh, is he a congressman or what?
Congressman in California.
Bob Hill, yeah. Uh-huh. Of course, Dr. Nicholson's work was actually verified in several of the VA labs. And then, of course, they set up a clinical trial, but they actually arranged the clinical trial to be sure that the people would not benefit. And you can arrange a clinical trial any way you want to. And this one, at least according to Dr. Nicholson, and we're talking about it afterwards, was specifically designed to fail. Why? Well, because, of course, if the patients benefited, then they're going to have to go ahead and treat all the patients. They're going to have to admit what had happened. And how
correct.
Can you admit? You can't admit that we infected the people, 90 million Americans, with simian virus 40, and then the rest of us with all these monkey cytomegalic viruses. Why we'd lose confidence in our government. And we can't admit that we, of course, contaminated hundreds of thousands of Gulf War veterans, and at least 40% of them carry the mycoplasma fermentans, which is a treatable disease. And of course, many of them are coming down, or a significant number with Lou Gehrig's disease. But of course, we can't let the American people know. And so everything is being done to cover it up. And did Dr. Nicholson ever get any of his grants through the military or through the government to carry out his experiments?
I believe he did, but you would have to ask him particularly on that. I know that he said on a written testimony at the Special Oversight Board of Department of Defense Investigations on Gulf War Chemical and Biological Incidents. This was dated November 19, 1998. He says, I firmly believe that it is now time to diagnose and treat the casualties, irrespective of how politically painful the truth may be. And that is absolutely correct. Sometimes truth is painful, and we have to, when we look at all of the people dying and suffering and having chronic illnesses needlessly, when it could be treated, then we have to look at the truth, and we have to find it out. And that's why I didn't stop until I found it.
Well, I'm glad that you actually, of course, did persist and continue your investigation, and they were able to actually get the records, you know, that pointed out that they were working with mycoplasma. They were infecting the prisoners with a cancer producing virus. That's what SV40 is, and they know it's a cancer producing virus, but they can't tell the American people that. Right now, of course, the incidence of mesothelioma, which is a very, very rare disease, seen only prior people who worked in asbestos, and
right
now a lot of people who never worked with asbestos are coming down with this. And, of course, when they analyze the tumors, why the majority of them contain the SV virus, SV40. And then, of course, this is passed on from mothers to their newborn children through the placenta, and of course these infections are persistent. If you take a blood transfusion, you take any of the blood products that have not been specifically treated to kill viruses, you're going to get not only, of course, the SV40, you're going to get all the monkey viruses, you're going to get the mycoplasma. All of these things are in the blood, and they're not testing for them, and they're not treating them to protect the American people. But how do we let the American people know that? Because if we knew they were there, why would we ask how they got there? If we ask how they got there, why we might begin reading books like The Health Century, published by, with the support of the National Institute of Health, and written by Edward Shorter. And if you can get a copy, it's your library, The Health Century, written by Edward Shorter, and learn the story of SV40 and the cancer virus infection in the American people and how it was covered up, and then, of course, what happened to the woman who actually discovered the cancer virus there. And these are incredible, incredible stories. And at that point, why, you're going to realize that you are primarily responsible for your own health, and you better start looking after it and trying to, of course, avoid treatment. Certainly doctors can do some wonderful things and amazing things that they can accomplish. But, of course, you always have to be concerned that the doctor may not at all recognize or even be aware of some of these macabre experiments that have been taking place in the past. And you talk to the average doctor about, of course, SV40, and they'll tell you that they've read in medical journals that it has nothing to do with cancer. And yet, of course, they were doing the experiments there with the prisoners, infecting them with SV40 intentionally to see what would happen. Do you have any idea what the results of those tests were? None of that is recorded in the material you have, and I'm talking about the incidence of cancer in the prisoners.
But I do know that the records are to be held at Baylor College of Medicine. I do know that because they state that in their own protocol. I'd like to mention Dr. Larry Goss. He wrote a document that he allowed me to use in this volume one that I put together for the representatives, the senators, and the House members. And it's Through the Looking Glass, A Country Doctor's Journey in the Labyrinth of Gulf War Syndrome. And it's dated 1998. And Dr. Goss and his wife had volunteered as a patriotic duty to treat Gulf War vets, right, at the nearby military bases. And he and his wife had both become ill. And his wife was diagnosed with a neurological disease. Now, he states, and I'll quote, "Mycoplasma fermentans incognitus is a very unusual and dangerous bacteria not found in the general population. The Uniformed Services University of the Health Services Microbiology Department, in their teaching syllabus, 1993-94, lists MFI, which means Mycoplasma fermentans incognitus, as presenting that of a fulminant systemic disease that begins as a flu-like illness. In 1995, the university dropped lectures discussing Mycoplasma fermentans due to curriculum reform."
Well, of course, I talked to Dr. Goss, maybe 3 or 4 years ago. I know he got treated, and he treated his wife, and she was doing pretty well last time I talked. Is he still working in the field, you know?
Yes, he is. He's still working. Yes, he's up in Oklahoma.
Yeah, okay, I won't ask you for his telephone number on the air, but do you have his number? I really should call him and get him on again.
I think I do have it, and I'll give it to you. I can send you an email later.
Yeah, would you mind? I'd really appreciate that.
Okay.
And I think it's so vitally important that Dr. Goss eventually, of course, went to work full-time trying to help the 800,000 to a million Americans who have this chronic fatigue syndrome. And, of course, you read the medical journals, they'll tell you they're all crazy. And, of course, you talk to the people at the VA, and they'll tell you everybody with Gulf War illness, they're all crazy. And they're simply lying. Now, some of them know it, some of them don't. But this is what they're told to tell the patients, and they're not allowed, even if they believe that these people are ill, they're not allowed to treat them in the Veterans Administration. And that, I think, is criminal.
Right, and I have another letter from Dr. Harold Clark, who worked with Dr. Thomas McPherson Brown, and this is a 1998 letter to Jane E. Henney, which is MD Director of FDA, from Dr. Clark, dated December 2nd, 1998. And Dr. Clark's caption in the letter is, "Are viral vaccines contaminated with mycoplasma antigens?"
Now, is what contaminants?
Are viral vaccines
contaminated
with mycoplasma antigens?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we know by what research I've done that they were using the recombinant DNA with the mycoplasma and viruses. So Dr. Clark goes on to say that about 40 years ago, 1956, our lab was first to report that mycoplasmas were unknowingly contaminating the tissue cultures the virologists used to grow viruses for vaccine preparation. This contamination still remains a problem today. 14 years later, when rubella vaccines were causing arthritis in recipients, I decided to test vaccines in viral pools for mycoplasma residue antigens. Unlike CFR-approved mycoplasma testing procedure based on negative cultures, the vaccines in viral pools were serologically tested in rabbits and found positive for non-viable mycoplasma antigens. If the swine flu vaccine had been tested for mycoplasma, perhaps much of the paralysis could have been avoided. For example, mycoplasma pneumoniae is a suspected cause of Guillain-Barré syndrome, the incidence of which is 6 times higher in persons receiving influenza vaccine than in persons who do not.
Well, that's a little frightening. And first, I know that Dr. Nicholson has mentioned that some of the anthrax vaccine that was given to our servicemen contained the mycoplasmas. Now, whether they're there accidentally or intentionally, we don't know. But an awful lot of the servicemen became very, very ill after getting their anthrax vaccine, at least during the first Gulf War. And as we know, a certain number of them got very sick during the second the Gulf War. And
well, some of the research that I've done showed that mycoplasma contaminants were just looked at as a contaminant, you know, like something that wasn't harmful to man, only later to find out that it was.
Well, you know, Chris, this is what had happened. When they gave the first polio vaccine to human beings, and this started in 1955, they simply grew the vaccine in the tissue culture of the rhesus monkey. And,
yes.
Of course, later on, of course, they began looking at the vaccine. This was after they'd given it to millions of people. And they said, whoops, well, here's a monkey virus. Here's another one. Here's another one. And they found 40 monkey viruses that they'd given, and we all contaminated with them. And then the 40th one was found, SV40, simian virus 40, was a cancer virus. And if you put that into hamsters, it produced mesothelioma and brain tumors, as I remember.
Right.
And, of course, we can't tell the American people that. Why, of course, they get a brain tumor, they're automatically going to blame it on SV40. They get a mesothelioma. I wrote an article on this. I had a congressman, a very good friend of mine, call me, and his wife had just died of mesothelioma. And what can you say to him? Well, I'm sorry, Bill, but, you know, this may very well have been where it came from. She had never had any contact with asbestos. And he was one of the leading congressmen there in Washington, D.C. for many, many years, and a fine patriot and a man who loves God. And the difficulty is that what can you say to a man who's just lost his wife from a disease caused by SV40? The only way you'd know for sure would be, of course, to have the tissue specimen checked for SV40, and this could be done. But what would it accomplish? Well, maybe it would accomplish something. People are going to have to get awfully angry. I'm going to be willing to take a stand against what's happened and hold the people responsible. And, of course, the company is responsible. If you can't hold the people, because a lot of these people, Sabin and Salk, are both passed away by now, but both of them knew exactly the dangers that they'd exposed the public to, and, of course, they didn't want the public to realize. They wanted to go down in history as the great, great scientists who'd come up with these wonderful experiments, this wonderful cure for polio, and it was a wonderful cure. But there had to be another means of growing the virus, and they took the easiest course, and they contaminated an entire generation of Americans. And the fact you haven't heard that simply reflects the degree of control that exists today of what the American people think. And the book you want to get to read at least about the initial problem would be the book The Health Century by Edward Shorter, commissioned by the NIH The second book would be Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life by Dr. Blaylock, that gets into the second group of viruses, the monkey cytomegalic viruses we got from the green monkey. And then, of course, we wonder why so many people have so many problems today. Well, Candace, was anything else, that some of the other things that you found?
Well, when I was discussing how they made fun of the Huntsville mystery illness and called it the TDC prison spokesperson said it was an urban legend, and that, and I'll quote this, much of the urban legend had its start with a one-time prison doctor, Garth Nicholson, who was with the prison system in the late 1980s and who today runs a type of think tank in California. Now, that none of that was true, and I had sent that, and then there was a rebuttal written in response to the Huntsville item story, mystery disease and urban legend. It would have been prudent for the writer to carefully check the facts and sources before writing the article. The public information officer for Texas Department of Criminal Justice has committed blatant slander and misinformation with libelous undertones by erroneously stating that much of the urban legend had its start with a one-time prison doctor, Garth Nicholson, who was with the prison system in the late 1980s and who runs today a type of think tank in California. Dr. Nicholson has never worked for the prison system. He was the founder and chairman of the MD Anderson Hospital Department of Tumor Biology for 16 years in Houston. He held the David Burton Chair, has been nominated for a Nobel Prize, published over 500 peer-reviewed articles, edited numerous books, and received numerous awards with his distinguished career. He has traveled and lectured extensively all over the world and has a continuously held NIH, NCI, and various private grants totaling millions of dollars. Recently, he was given the Stephen Paget Award, the highest honor given to a researcher of cancer metastasize, and shared the medical humanitarian Albert Schweitzer Award with his wife, Dr. Nancy Nicholson. Now, this was written by Dr. Nancy Nicholson in a rebuttal to this urban legend article that was written in the Huntsville Item. So this keeps going on. And then there was an article written in 1999, March 8th, The Germ of a Theory by Rick Wise of the Washington Post. Now, I've talked with Rick Wise on the phone. But in this particular article, what got me was that there was a 17-year Canadian study, which stated that juvenile rheumatoid arthritis had evidence that it would rise whenever there was Mycoplasma pneumoniae. So there was a peak in the same time that there was juvenile rheumatoid arthritis as when there was Mycoplasma pneumoniae, or otherwise known as walking pneumonia. And that was a 17-year Canadian study. So that helped with furthering what has gone on here, that particular Washington Post paper.
So Rick Wise then put in an honest paper and a good analysis?
Right.
And you will occasionally find some excellent articles in the Washington Post, and I think it's one of the finest newspapers in the country. I like it far better than I like the Wall Street Journal.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Because I know where the editorial staff is coming from, but at least they print some honest articles, which, of course, the Wall Street Journal pretends to be so conservative, but it really isn't at all.
No.
All right, fine. Well, of course, you know, the information is gradually getting out there. But all we can do, of course, is programs like this, and hope Candace will come on our other programs from time to time. And, of course, we have five different audiences. We do every day, every week, four of them. And then, of course, we have our Saturday program. And actually, we have two Saturday programs. So there's actually, we have the potential for six different audiences. And what a unique opportunity to reach people with the news they're not going to get elsewhere.
The problem I have with the government right now reviewing Dr. Nicholson's studies and what he's finding is that the one person who is known as the father of mycoplasma, which is Dr. Shai-Ching Lo, he is the one that has to say, yes, the studies are correct. Now, that was written in the Popular Science magazine April issue 1999, and the title of it was What's Really Causing Gulf War Illness? And it's just unbelievable. In this article it states, one of the big obstacles to acceptance of Nicholson's theory has been the finding of Shai-Ching Lo of the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology in Washington, D.C. Lo, sometimes called the father of fermentans, first isolated the strain from AIDS patients in the late 80s and argued that mycoplasma infection might be the final blow that kills them. As far back as 1994, when Nicholson first went public with his theory, the Army asked Lo to confirm Nicholson's results by testing blood for M. fermentans. Lo's findings were negative. Even Lo admits that in any scientific study, a negative result doesn't really mean anything.
Well, didn't they mishandle intentionally the blood specimens to make sure that there wouldn't be any findings?
They mishandled a lot of the blood samplings from the people from Huntsville and also other people that I know some people have gone to his lab and saw how it was left out in the open.
And, of course, he's still working for the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology. He's a government employee, isn't he?
And that's the one that's got to say that Dr. Nicholson's research is valid.
Well, of course, if he said it's valid, then he'd probably lose his job, his pension, all of his benefits. Unfortunately, when you have scientists work for the government, why are they going to give the results the government wants? That is the tragedy, and of course it ceases to be science. It's all about politics and deception and deceit.
Right.
In many ways, it's truly Machiavellian. We're just about out of time. What are your parting thoughts for our listeners tonight, Candace?
Well, I think if they want to find the truth, if there's any clusters of illnesses around their homes, they need to look at the prison system, because I'm sure the prison systems have had some sort of experiments. They'd have to do a Freedom of Information Act, and in order to find it, it's a lot of trouble, but it's well worth it, especially when I can look at my son today and see him walking. And there were other people who have called me from all over the United States and had asked, had said that their children were coming down with the same symptoms, and they asked me for the information, and I gave it to them freedly, and then sent them on to Dr. Garth Nicholson. But this has been quite a journey for me. And I'm still in Huntsville. I'm not running. I'm here. And I'm going to stay here, and I'm going to keep researching.
Well, God bless you for what you do and for your courage, Candace. I wish we had about 100 million of you out there. We wouldn't be in the mess we are today. God bless you, and please get me that telephone number for Dr. Larry Goss. I'd like
yes,
to
call
and get him on again.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good night.
Good
God
night.
Bless you.
God bless you.
Well, that was, of course, Candace, and I hope you enjoyed Candace. Very, very courageous lady who has laid her life right on the line, because, believe me, Dr. Nicholson has told me that at least three people are his medical students. My understanding was that they had all died under mysterious circumstances. Looking into that, could that happen in America today? Well, about 22 major scientists have died here in the last year or two. They're all microbiologists, all heads of their field from countries throughout the world. And Steve Quayle covers that on his website, and so does Jay Rentz, although I think Steve does a better job. Anyway, we're out of time. We ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival. We ask you to seriously consider joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow evening, when we hope we'll be back with you, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.